when the mirror fell over, and he tried to stop it as far as he could. So he was pushed down, and he was knocked down by this rail, and the mirror came falling over, and this heavy frame, which would have gone right through his chest, crushed him, hit the rail, and stopped. Of course, it stopped about 200 millimeters above the floor, which was about the thickness of his chest. But he had such a nervous problem anyway that this gave him a more or less a nervous breakdown.
Oh.
And he was never really able to come back to work. Another situation. Now, these are things that part of our standard problem over there because of the war, the people being in war. Mm-hmm. We don't realize that over here. They talk about the problems that the Vietnam veterans have had,
mm-hmm.
which maybe is similar.
Right.
But, and you go back when I was a kid, they talked about the soldiers being shell-shocked. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Right.
Of course, a lot of these people were not directly involved in the war. They were children, or their families were displaced, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of tragedies. We had a we needed plastics type people, so we had run an ad, and we hired a fellow by the name of Metz, and he was from Eastern Europe. I was trying to remember now which was it. I don't think it was Hungary, Yugoslav. I'm not real sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he had been in the SS, and the Germans sort of hated him. They didn't like him. The rest of the people there.
Oh right, I can imagine.
And he was a terrific talent, terrific hard worker in mm-hmm. that type of work. Anyway, he hired in. He worked there a few days. I think he was at that particular time working at the Vaughan Museum
mm-hmm.
as a doing reproductions and so forth for the Bond Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And he hired in. He worked, I think, less than a week. He came in and said he wanted to quit. I think the people were giving him too hard of a time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I talked with the guy and said, gee, we really need you and you're doing an excellent job and all this. And
mm-hmm.
through an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so he went, and next day he was back. His wife sent him back. So we took him back in, He worked the next time, 2, 3, 4 weeks, and he quit again. Similar thing happened. He came back again. Well, I could depend on the guy. I could tell him to do this and that and whatever. Why, geez, he would just try his hardest and work very hard doing whatever I had to ask him, because mm-hmm. I always treated him right.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually he did some very interesting things, and we did some very unusual developments, leading the together with Kirsting, whom he worked under, actually,
uh-huh.
and the ideas that we were developing. And Kirsting had a contact with what was known as Bayer Leverkusen, the Bayer chemical company.
Uh-huh.
Leverkusen being the city directly across the Rhine from where we were, where their plant was. So anything that we wanted to do in plastics, he'd call up over there and talk with the people in charge of their experimental chemical research areas and said we want to do this or that. And
how do you spell labor?
Well, I'd have to get out of my German map.
Well, just give
L E V E R K U S E N.
And Bayer, of course, B-A-Y-E-R.
Yes.
It was the chemical aspirin. The chemical company. Yeah.
Chemical company. And for instance, we did the first epoxy resin negatives and positives.
How'd that come about?
Well, they were using polyester over here and not able to control surface. And so when we started cast in fiberglass over there, why, he got a hold of people and they gave him the mixes, and we did that. We would do our own foaming of like soft parts.
When you say rest. Foam, you mean styrofoam?
No, sponge.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yeah.
Skin and foam armrests. In fact, at one of the I think at one of the auto shows, they I don't know, they did it at the auto show, except that they did it for a TV preview of the auto show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing this in our styling area, you know. Before I left, which was in 67, we did a complete interior soft. Interior, making our own form designs out of clay, casting them, mm-hmm. casting the foam panels for these, and then doing the upholstery on top of that.
What would be the composition of what you call foam?
Well, it was a at that time it was a plastic mm-hmm. foam.
Right.
I suppose a polyurethane.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well. Some of the things that we accomplished also in relative to this fellow and relative to plaster and plastics.
Mm-hmm.
As time went on, we grew into larger areas of this old building. We took over another area that experimental engineering had, and they had bridges. Interesting. They had a line and bridges similar to the permanent bridges in Design Center.
Oh, yeah.
And they used these as their reference or to position the parts in building up prototype bodies,
mm.
which is rather unique.
Yeah.
So we needed more room and we needed more bridge capacity, so we took over the end of their bridge line and used one of their bridges in doing the station wagon version of this P3, this new 17M,
mm-hmm.
in this old building. And then they had started a new building on the same piece of property for design, a mm-hmm. considerably larger building and new. So we moved into that, I think, maybe 2 years after we were there. And we got our own bridges. We got a long line. I think we had maybe three workplaces and two bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another building in between that we took over. And we put our fab shops in there, trim shop and this fiberglass. By that time there was a little bit of plaster work being done, but most of it was being done in fiberglass. But we didn't have a surface plate. So Kirsten got a hold of Bayer Leverkusen, and I think maybe the idea was his, I don't know, somebody's idea. They talked about this, and we made a little trial test of a poured epoxy surface plate.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this new building, when they laid the floor in an area the size of a large surface plate, he had the concrete poured so it would be quite level and I don't recall what we laid down for a frame. It could have been just a clay extrusion, or it could have been wood pieces that they cast into the floor or something. Anyway, within this area, which I suppose was like 2 meters by, I don't know, 7, 8 meters, must be at least 8 meters, maybe 10 meters long. 2 meters? Must have been more than that. Must have been at least 3 meters. 3 or 4 meters wide and maybe 10 meters long. They mixed up the epoxy and poured it. It was a thin mix, a special type, and one that would take considerable time to cure. Mm-hmm. And poured it in this area and let it set up. It found its own level. Mm-hmm. And let it set up, and then they went in and polished it a little bit. You know, didn't take a whole lot, but they did polish it. Mm-hmm. And then they scribed the center line and other reference lines into this metric reference grid line. Mm-hmm. So we had a surface plate, mm-hmm, that was flat, made out of epoxy, and maybe it cost $500 or something. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to buy one. Mm-hmm. And we probably couldn't have gotten delivery on one anyway. Well, he would do things on the outside also, this fellow Metz, this plastic fellow. And one of the things which I had started to tell you about was that at some point in time they wanted replications of the Magi chest that is in the Cologne Cathedral.
Oh yes, I remember.
And according to history, according to what their records say, it holds the remains of the Magi. It also has many special stones that have been carved, mm-hmm, into it of various figures, and it's all gold, and it's invaluable as a treasure. Mm-hmm. So he made molds of this, and he had given me a set of these casts.
Yes, incredible.
And some of these, I don't know off what
these are.
These are
sort of bas reliefs of the warriors' heads on the cast.
Yeah, cameos. There's a Ptolemaic cameo, which is a king's head. Mars and Venus in another. Nero in another. I think that. Anyway, so he had, from time to time, he would give me things that they would make up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a very hard-working guy, and
this was Mr. Metz,
this
former
was Mr. Metz. Nobody ever liked him, and except I liked him, mm-hmm, because
as a worker,
he was a good worker, and he always treated me right, and I never had any difficulty with him.
Mm-hmm.
Was very honest and above board with what he did. He wasn't German, you know. And this made a difference.
How was he?
Well, he was, like I say, he was Eastern European. And I'm not sure. I'd have to. Came from one of the Eastern European countries.
Mm-hmm.
Yugoslavia, someplace.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he had been in the SS, and this made a mark on him.
A social stigma.
Moral and social stigma. But he had a lame leg, so he always had that to carry with. But eventually, and this goes down several years now, and we'll talk about him. His wife was not happy, and she wanted to go back to her own country, her own folks. Mm-hmm. And which was kind of difficult for him too, you know. The fact that she wasn't happy there, and he was, I think. Mm-hmm. And so he became ill and was...
Physically?
Physically. Mm-hmm. And was in the hospital, and I think lost a... lost a kidney or part of his liver or something. It was a very, you know, very severe illness. Mm-hmm. Well, every once in a while, he would have a difficult situation, and he would say, "Can I come to clay modeling?" I said, "Well, sure. Anytime that you want to come to clay modeling, you can come." I said, "You're very valuable where you're at." Mm-hmm. And but if things get to the point where you can't get along anymore, why, sure, you can come into clay modeling. Of course, he was the leader of the group, and he made quite a high salary. Mm-hmm. And so he was concerned because transferring into clay modeling, why they would, the rest of the people tell him, no, they'd cut his salary. Well, I wouldn't cut his salary. Mm-hmm. He had been too valuable to us. So anyway, he became ill and was in the hospital for some time. And during the period that he was in the hospital, his wife divorced him and left.
Oh dear.
So he had always been a very strong-willed guy, and fighting all these people that were against him, you know, standing up for what he thought was right. Whether he was right or not, I don't know. But anyway, this broke him.
Oh dear.
So eventually, he came back, and he wasn't able to, of course, at that time, continue with the fiberglass, plastic, plaster work. Mm-hmm. And so I brought him into clay modeling. And so he was, you know, he was capable. He was able to do most anything. Mm-hmm. Except the type of jobs that we intend to give him were a job that he would could work on alone, so he didn't have to take all of this noise from everybody. Mm-hmm. Well, he took a trip someplace by air. Lufthansa, within Germany there, I think, someplace. And he met a stewardess on Lufthansa, I think, on this flight, somehow. And eventually, he married her, and they had children. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, changing his story around to a more or less happy ending. But, so, but he was one of the people that I had really depended on, during, especially during that early stage, the early several years.
You stayed out through most of your tenure.
He was there. My wife and I went back in 77, and I went back in 78, and he was still there.
Mm-hmm. He'd learned to live with the...
He'd learned to live with it. Very quiet by that time, you know. He used to be noisy, but by that time he was very quiet. Well, some of the things that happened, the other things that happened, we completed this model, the P3, the new 17M that was going to come out in September of 1960, as a 61 model. Well, early in 59, they wanted a wind tunnel test of it, because this is something they did over there. And so they had a drawing, they made a wood model, and took the wind tunnel, and they were amazed because the drag was 20% less than what the other car had been. The previous car. This was the old one. This was the new one.
What a difference! Yes. Can you explain the difference in audio terms?
Well, the older one really looked like a 55 Ford.
That was the 17M.
That was also the 17M. That was the Gil Spear job.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does, doesn't it?
And a scaled down version of it.
Mm-hmm.
It had the leaning forward fenders and headlight bezels.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, you know, which was the wrong, absolutely wrong thing to do. Why they would take an American car anyway and copy it for a German car,
mm-hmm.
You should just never do that. But that's what they did. And now this was the facelift version. The other one, the previous one. This one we had lowered the roof. We had a very bulbous roof and mm-hmm. a very big round back window. So we lowered the roof and inset the back window. So the superstructure on this looked rather neat when we got finished. But it had virtually the same front end and rear end.
Yes, the headlights. I had a 55 Ford. That looked much like it.
Yes.
That was my first new car.
Yeah.
It was very much like it, yes.
Had a rather large fat roll on the side and
mm-hmm.
really didn't fit the German market, whereas the new 17M was very low in front, had a lot of plan view sweep, in other words a lot of curve in the sides.
Mm-hmm.
It had a compound curved windshield, which was the sort of the current thing with Ford,
mm-hmm.
60 Ford,
mm-hmm.
and our 61 Ford, whichever it was, 60 Ford I guess. And the back, the side of the model, or the side of the vehicle had this sort of oval shape. And so it had, just looking at it, it looked streamlined. You know?
Yes, right.
As well as being 20% less drag, it weighed, I think, 210 pounds less.
Incredible.
And it had an all-new four-speed transmission.
Mm.
And it had somewhat more power. So it became, it was a very excellent road car,
mm-hmm.
and fast, and quite economical from what they'd had previously.
Mm-hmm.
So it made a tremendous splash on the German, the European car industry.
Yeah.
And won at that time several accolades, several awards.
Mm-hmm.
But they put this wood model in the wind tunnel and they found out that it had this reduced drag. Well, of course, that really got John Andrews going. So we got involved in new programs, and they wanted to do wind tunnel studies as we developed the cars.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of the things I had been interested in for many, many years.
And where was the wind tunnel at that point?
In Stuttgart. It was
Stuttgart.
It was a wind tunnel that had been used for the aircraft industry.
Uh-huh.
And was actually on within the confines of Daimler-Benz grounds.
Oh, really?
They had a full size and a scale model.
They rented those facilities out to various industries.
Yeah, I don't think it was owned by Daimler-Benz, but you know that's where
mm-hmm.
it was. The Daimler-Benz had grown up around them.
Mm-hmm.
So we would take our models down there and test them. But basically what happened was that it was most desirable to do this early. It takes a long time to make a wood model exact, and you didn't have the time or the people or the money to do this. And the only reason they did this first model in wood was the model was complete and was going to go into production. They needed a record, and they needed one that they could keep and say that's our Reference
model.
So we developed a system for what I always call tuning clay models in the wind tunnel. And basically what this was developing a two-piece unit, one being the chassis, which was removable, and the other was the body, which would go on top of them, and developing an armature upon which you could apply clay. And for testing, you would mount this body on the chassis. And we would put it in a box, and some of them we'd carry right with us. These were 1/5 scale. We'd carry right with us on the train. Or they'd put it in a truck and haul it down, you know.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And so later I wrote a paper on this. And that's in here, in this book. And I suppose by rights you should keep that book.
May I?
The red one.
Thank you.
Yeah. We should go through it and see what all is there and see if there's anything else you need. Desire to study the clay model in the wind tunnel while you are developing the clay is very important if you're going to consider aerodynamics or drag factor as one of your factors of design. So there needed to be a system developed to accomplish this, and this was done during really I think perhaps later in 59 and in 60, when we first did the first clay models, may have been sometime in 60, I'm not real sure. 59 or 60. And basically the way that we did this was to, after the initial presentation of a model, and it was approved as a direction, they would take templates and points from the model and make a drawing, and make a drawing to the scale, which was 1/5, very exact. And we had people that could do this. From this drawing, they would develop an armature for the body, which would be, of course, undersized by some small amount. And this would have a method of mounting to the chassis, which would be the lower part. And this would be prepared prior to starting the clay work. And when this was ready to start the clay work, the armature portion for the body would then be mounted on a platform on a table. And the exact drawing, which would include exact body sections of the model, every hundred millimeters to scale, would be used to make templates. And the way that they would do this, they would take the master drawing, and they would make photo. Copies on Mylar, so that they were exact from the drawing, and they would have these Mylar copies from which they would make aluminum templates. So the templates were very carefully made. They were made by people in experimental engineering who were used to making templates for their engineering purposes. So they were made, again, quite exact. And these were then used to set into the clay model. And the model would be built up to these, and of course detail portions of this by would be completed from detailed information from the model. By doing this, you'd get an exact body replication to scale,
of the full-size model that you had developed, or was going through further mm-hmm. developments,
right.
and plus any final changes that might have been incorporated at that particular time. So this could be done fairly readily, as you had gone through some development for this wind tunnel model, and you would have the armatures prepared, and you would the body development work, of course, precedes certainly some of the detail front and rear end work that you do on an all new model.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it can proceed ahead of other things. So you can start preparing a wind tunnel model somewhat in advance of the final show.
Mm-hmm.
This model then would be assembled, and we would take it to the wind tunnel. And usually it was more than one, because when you're working on a program, you've got maybe two or three alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So you would make more than one model and take them to the wind tunnel and test them and make certain adjustments or changes in the wind tunnel as it seemed right to do. Ford Werke, Ford of Germany, had an aerodynamicist or an engineer who had this knowledge. And so when we'd go to the wind tunnel, he would go along. His name was Betterman. And I would always take one of the designers and myself, at least. So I went to virtually all of the wind tunnel studies. And we would, when we had certain problems, whatever they might be, or we wanted to try to improve the drag coefficient, why we would make various changes that would seem, from the point of view of appearance and manufacturing engineering, those changes that could be accepted. And many times the aerodynamicists in the wind tunnel would recommend things that were just not acceptable at all, you know, so I'd have to rule them out and do things that only were practical.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we started this in December of 59, I believe. And this NPXC, as that model was called, was the forerunner of the Cardinal.
Oh, yes.
You had asked about the Cardinal.
Yes.
We had developed a very nice little model. It was going to be the replacement for the 12M. It was front engine, rear drive, and a beautiful little model. And U.S. Management decided that they wanted to have German... They wanted to have Germany also build the same vehicle. And, of course, what they were developing over here was a completely different design. It was a larger vehicle to begin with. Larger, heavier, larger engine. Really, again, like the previous 17M, did not fit European or German automobile, passenger car automobile requirements. And from the point of view of appearance, it didn't fit either, engineering-wise or appearance-wise. And Karl Stolberg made a lot of noise. John Andrews was more or less told, well, this is what you've got to do. And so early in 1960, I think sometime in January, people came from the U.S. to Germany and looked at our model and reviewed what our plans were. Well, they were adamant about having a joint program, and however, they would consent to using Cologne's design.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
You know, this is easy to say, but it just doesn't work that way. We had designed a small, lightweight front engine rear drive, and here they had a front wheel drive of a configuration where the engine had to set out in front of the front axle, which meant that it had to be a long hood. And it was a bigger package and just did not fit the package or the appearance package that we had developed for this little car. But again, we were this was at the time when in the World Bank or the McNamara was in control. So he would rattle a piece of people's cages and say, you gotta do this or that. So anyway, later in January, I came back to the United States to develop, with drawings, to develop the Cardinal to the design character that we had developed in Germany, to the best of our ability. Now, the one thing we were going to do in Germany was to cast the roof and send the roof over to put on the clay model here. And so as far as the greenhouse would be concerned, it would be our greenhouse on an American package lower. I suppose they must have adjusted that greenhouse to some extent to fit that package. And but they took the design details off of our roof. And the lower would be modeled over here, and I guess cast, so that they would have a cast lower and upper, except that'd be separate models. So I came over, and I believe this study was under John Major.
Mm-hmm.
And we developed that design theme. So I was here about 6 weeks and developed it, and they finished it up and showed it. In the meantime, they shipped the roof over. I suppose the first showing was clay lower dynocked and with this cast ship from Germany set over. And that's what became the Cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
So,
was this seriously considered as a United States vehicle?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went sort of right down the line of ordering tools. I don't think they ever ordered tools.
Mm-hmm.
And Germany got stuck with it. It wasn't what they wanted. It wasn't their model. The design, well, you know, by the time you modify the design to fit the American package, it was just another animal.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was to be their small, the Ford small car.
In the States.
In the States, yes.
Mm-hmm.
What went wrong? Who made the decision?
Well, I suppose Henry Ford made the decision finally, like he did on other programs, like he did on the Prelat, was it? Not the the one where he fired fellow with the Chrysler.
Engel.
No. Sperlik.
Oh, Sperlik. Oh yes.
Same thing. Ford wasn't ready for it himself.
That's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Could be that they did a market research study and found that the people didn't want a small car. I don't know.
Yes.
But they decided that they weren't going to do it here. And so, Germany, you can have it. And something I found out only after I was back from Germany. The last time we used to have these parties with I don't think I've mentioned that in here. One of the things that John Andrews would do shortly after we were over there in the summer of 58. He got all these Ford families together, the wives, the children, everybody at his place, first of all, his place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big house, and they had a lot of room, they had a big yard, and everybody, all each wife of the family bought a dish, you know, They had this big spread.
Potluck.
And the kids would have this potluck, and the kids would play games, you know, and then he would call a meeting. Ad hoc committee, ad hoc, what did he call it? Belleville, something or other. He must have lived in Belleville, around the lake there.
Mm-hmm.
Ad hoc committee, and he would, you know, this is what he did every day. So he would have a meeting of all his sport families, you know, go over this stuff, funny stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And after we were all back, we had two or three of those parties over here.
Uh-huh.
And the last one that I was to, there was one after that that I wasn't going, I wasn't able to go to just before he died. But this was during the time that he did have leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And before he died, they had a party. And he got telling some of these stories. And one of the stories was, and it's a shame he didn't act on it, except it would have upset his production plans. But it would have been to his advantage in the long run. He said that Henry Ford came over and reviewed the, I suppose it was the time that they decided not to build the Cardinal here in the States. Mm-hmm. And they were only going to do it in Europe. And Henry Ford asked Johns Andrews, are you... are you not satisfied, but are you, do you feel sufficiently, let's see what I want to say, confident
mm-hmm.
with this vehicle?
Comfortable
with it. Mm-hmm. If you want, you can cancel it, and you can go to something else, or go back to what you did have.
In terms of Germany or the United States?
For Germany.
Yeah, okay.
Because they'd already dropped it here. They made a decision. I presume it was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that Ford must have heard all of this commotion. That people, there were a lot of people making noise about it because it was something that was being forced on Germany, and Germany didn't really want it.
Right.
So he asked John Andrews and gave him the opportunity to cancel it out,
mm-hmm.
which was something.
Yeah.
And John said no, so we'll go with it.
Why did he say that?
I think, like I say, because John had certain production plans, mm-hmm. plans to do certain things, and this fell in a certain slot.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had said no, it would have been another year or a year and a half, 2 years mm-hmm. before he would have been able to come out with a replacement for that vehicle.
It became part of the Tonneau series, didn't it?
Yes. So they came out with that.
What was its actual designation?
Well, they called it 12M,
12M,
15M.
Yeah.
Let's see if I've got a catalog of that one. I had one of them. Most of the time, I had lease cars over there, but that particular time, I don't know why anymore, I owned one.
Uh-huh.
And, like I say, it had the engine, something like the Audi. The Audi, so-called Audi, has the engine in front of the front axle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's front-wheel drive. It has the gearbox behind the axle, and then it drives through. But this was a Cardinal.
Ah, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, I had a coupe, and it really didn't handle very well. It was so nose-heavy and didn't have particularly good... shocks in it. So I had a garage take out, I guess, one of the front, it had a cross leaf spring. I had them take out one of the spring leafs. It had the battery sticking way out in front. I took the battery. It had a space like this behind the engine, between the engine and the firewall, with nothing in it.
Really?
So I took the battery and I put it there.
Uh-huh.
And it had 13-inch wheels, And they had 14-inch wheels available on the station wagon. So I put 14-inch wheels on it. Had to change, I guess, maybe the brake drums or something to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I put lowering blocks in the rear. And maybe I put different shocks on. I'm not sure about the shocks anymore. Anyway, it made quite a reasonable handling car. Uh-huh. And, of course, it looked a lot better because it stood about a couple of inches lower.
Mm-hmm.
But, so that was the Cardinal program.
Well, can you describe it in audio terms?
That particular vehicle?
This particular one, yeah. And what advantages it had on the European market?
Well, since they took the design from the German development, which was a considerably smaller car, mm-hmm. by many inches,
mm-hmm.
It had a short rear deck, the German development.
Mm-hmm.
And as I had mentioned, the front wheel drive arrangement that they had on this had a very long hood. So in this respect, it had an old look to it in that it had this big, powerful front end on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It had a sort of a side body side molding in a V section that ran from the center of the headlight back through the side of the vehicle back to the taillights,
mm-hmm.
and became the outermost edge of the taillight, really not greatly different than what happened at the very end on the 49 Ford. If you take that short spear on a 49 Ford that ended up in the taillight,
mm-hmm.
and you extend that spear through the side of the vehicle, this was done in sheet metal, of course,
mm-hmm.
why it was that sort of a theme. It picked up this sort of oval theme as far as the top of the fender is concerned. It had the cowl arrangement coming around the windshield that ran around the side, which again was one of my developments.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the 49 Ford was that the fender went to the window, mm-hmm. and it made it always look like its pants were pulled up too high.
Yeah, it's a slab side effect.
Slab side effect.
Mm-hmm.
By lowering the fender line those couple of inches, you get a much more pleasing side elevation.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives the greenhouse a more or less more significant appearance.
Who was responsible for the design in the States? Do you remember offhand? Did you ever hear?
Well, it was an adaptation of the German design. Like
okay.
I say, it was,
yeah.
I think, under John Najjar at the time.
Oh,
at least
that's
when
right.
I was over.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But of course, the engineering detail was out of our control.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that we developed over there was very neat as far as the cross sections were concerned. And this is one of the things that I developed also in Germany. I would do the cross section, I'd give them the body engineering, I said, do you like this?
Mm-hmm.
And so it came out being, you know, not nearly as neat as the type of thing that we might have done over there.
You found it a hybrid that was sort of...
It was a hybrid, sure.
Forced on you.
That's correct. Well, it had this great big long hood and this short rear deck.
Yeah.
So, within a couple of months of production, I'm talking about what they call the 4 Serie over there, the pre-production.
What do they call it?
4 Serie, before the series production.
Is that a German word?
Mm-hmm.
How to spell it?
I guess F-O-R, Syria, S-E-R-I-A, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you
are. E-I-A, I-E-A, I-E-A, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall how or who decided this should be done, but it was decided that they should lengthen the deck lid 7 inches. 7 inches?
That's interesting.
Huh?
Yeah.
So that the rear end would go with the front end. You know, better, get a better
sure.
balance.
Yeah, right.
Because the front end had been lengthened that much at least.
Mm-hmm.
So they lengthened the deck lid 7 inches. The thing that this did do and I have to admit this, that they came out with a 12 amp, which is the German small car at the time, that had a tremendous trunk. And in fact, it was a big car. Mm-hmm. It had a big interior. It had a larger interior than we would have had with our development. Mm-hmm. However, it didn't sell, you know, like it would have otherwise. What mm-hmm. we developed was, in effect, a much more pleasant, as far as appearance is concerned, anyway, and Ford built a good car than what the Opel Kadett was. It was in the size of what would have what came out as an Opel Kadett. You know, it would have been one-on-one at that point.
Your version or the
our version?
Yeah, okay.
Our version.
You were designing for the European market.
We were designing for the European market, and we had a design that would really have sold. Mm-hmm. But instead, they came out with a car that was considerably larger, and therefore much more expensive to build.
What kind of warped mind came up with this foreign concept?
I don't know. Well, it was McNamara. McNamara is, I'll give you, if you want some papers to read, whereby some people figure that he's in a position right now to scuttle the United States as well as Ford, you know. This is what's happening with the World Bank.
Okay, yeah.
He has no feeling for people or situations. He's worse than a bull in a China shop in that respect. And,
a human computer with no compassion. No,
I guess that's it.
No real political sensitivity.
So
same thing at Ford, apparently. He was,
during that time he was there, yeah. It was a hard time for Ford, I think, during that period. Ford was glad he went up.
I think there were some sighs of relief.
Yes.
When he accepted the Kennedy offer.
Another project we worked on. We had come out with this facelift on the 17 M, and it sold like hotcakes. They couldn't make them fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So to increase,
what year was that?
Well, it came out in the fall of '60 as a '61 model, mm-hmm. and it was built through '64, and so I guess it was built maybe 4 years. Huh? The facelift must have come out in the fall of '64, perhaps as a '65, which was that one.
Mm-hmm.
In order to increase production, it wasn't just a matter of saying, "Well, okay, let's speed up the line." There was no capacity available. Suppliers had no capacity. You know, everything was full.
Mm-hmm.
There were no workmen. There were no plants, there were no tools, no machines.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a tremendous task to increase production. Well, Ford, when we first went over there, I think had something like 9% of the market, which wasn't large, you know, it wasn't particularly small either. It was a good hunk.
Mm-hmm.
But
the German market or the European market?
I think the German market.
Yeah.
They, of course, wanted to increase this. So in order to increase it, they had to build factories, they had to buy tools. They sent people to Yugoslavia, Italy, and Spain, principally, and hired workers. They brought them to Cologne. They built apartment houses, furnished the apartment houses, trained the people, provided the means for them to live during this interim period, and built the factories, and helped their suppliers build plants in order to increase production.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine those sorts of problems.
Oh. Oh.
Nevertheless, they increased their production in Germany during the time we were there, I think, up to about 20%. And of course, during that time, production generally had expanded.
How about market penetration?
I think up to about 20%.
Oh, market penetration, 20%. Oh, okay.
20%. I'm not sure what it is right
now. That was quite a jump.
Yes. During this period of time, when we first went there, of course, the company, any deviation from your cost of living from the United States, they would jest. Mm-hmm. When we first went there, we really went over and we were considered by the German government to be aiding them in re-establishing their manufacturing facilities. Uh-huh. And so we were given special consideration as far as tax breaks mm-hmm. were concerned right. Initially. And they also had a special consideration for family. And we would get, I think, an amount of like 5 marks a month for at least a third child. Ooh. So Timmy would get five marks a month because of third child. Well, we, as quick as this 17M was out, and we had gone through the development of the this Cardinal program. They wanted to do John Andrews wanted to do a facelift on the 17M. Well, what he really wanted was to do a new car. But this is how shrewdly and how effectively he would work. You know, it's just amazing. and he wanted a larger car. He wanted one that would compete with the Opel Capitan. Mm-hmm. And so even when we worked on the 17M, he was always talking about that. And then when we started working on this model and the facelift, he wanted two sizes. He would call the smaller one the Hummer, which is what that was.
The Hummer,
which is lobster.
Lobster.
Hummer. Have you ever heard of Hummer?
How do you spell it?
H-U-M-M-E-R.
H-U-M-M-E-R. E-R. Like the French Omar.
I suppose it would be in French, it might be pronounced Hummer. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, H-O-M-E-R-D.
Okay, well, you always call it Hummer. And Langusta.
Which is
another type of...
Of lobster.
Yes.
In Italian.
That might be.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
the Italian and the French.
Langusta has survived in an Italian design.
Yeah, okay. I see these two, AMC came out with this truck for the army. Mm-hmm. And they called it the Hummer.
Did they really?
Yes. Isn't that Langusta came out in what now? In something?
About 10 years.
As a Ford Special or something, or? I remember it somewhere. I don't remember what.
I'm not sure. I'd have to look it up.
I'm not sure either. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, the Langusta was the larger car. Of course, it would have the same body, but it would have a larger engine, mm-hmm. you know, so forth.
Both variations on the Langusta.
Variation on this model. And, so this is how he went about it. We started a facelift. And about this time, you know, we went through the Cardinal program, and these American company people were getting more and more involved again with what was going on over there. So we would have combined programs. They would do models over here and ship them over, and we would show our models with them and so forth. So then Della Rosa came over for about a month. Mm-hmm. And
in his capacity is what?
Well, to help us do a facelift.
Oh, okay.
So Dahlberg did a facelift, and he did a facelift. Mm-hmm. And we came to a final presentation of this, and we had this show. We did windmill studies. I've got probably have photographs there. Mm-hmm. And when I left, I took it with me. Otherwise, it would have been
thrown away. I'm glad you saved it.
And that's something that should go in the archives.
Great.
Because it was never done before that. Mm-hmm. Never done. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Della Rosa came over and worked on this model. Leonard Stobart came over. Also. And he came over to help Della Rosa. So he was sort of running along, you know. Mm-hmm. And Andrews influenced the Vorstand to buy off Delrose's model.
Buy it off?
No, to buy that one.
Oh, to buy
accept
it.
That one.
Oh, know, accept that one, all right.
Approve that facelift.
Mm-hmm.
So they did. Dahlberg's was over here, you know, and really looked better, but the in-house design sort of pushed to the side.
Why did Andrews do that?
Well, to as a means to get people, Americans that were in controlling, that were influencing what was going on,
mm-hmm.
so that he was not fighting them. He's with them.
Okay.
Yeah, he's with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we like what you sent your man over here, and we like what he did, and we've approved his model.
He didn't want to be known as that obstructionist in Cologne.
That's right. They approved it. The next day, he puts a memo through canceling that project and incorporating a whole new project, a whole new car.
How was he able to do that? After Delarosa left and everybody thought that they had accepted it?
Well, you know, this is how he worked. You know, he had all the pins lined up there, and he hit that first one, and they all laid down.
That's marvelous. He was able to bring it up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. So, well, this is really the way John worked, and he was able to influence people. He was on top of everything. Sales were high and always increasing, and there were no problems. Company, U.S. Foreign Motor Company officials would come to Germany and review what was happening. There were no complaints, you know. So he had everybody's ear, and it was just a marvelous time. John would have these ideas of what he would want to do, or had in the back of his mind certain basic things that he would like to accomplish. He would come over to design, like 10 o'clock in the morning, and he would go around and look at the different models with Dahlberg, and usually I was with them too, and the administrator, and probably Bonson. We'd walk around and look at different things and look at what we were doing and what he would like and what he could see should be done. Then we'd go in, he would have lunch sent over, and then send over a couple platters of very nice sandwiches and coffee and whatever.